Welcome back, everyone.
In this episode, we will be talking about the situation in Venezuela and the EU directive on protection of whistleblowers. But before we start, just to let you know that we were interviewed by the Green World magazine about the podcast, why we started it, green representation in the media, and about making political ecology more accessible. So yeah, check it out. We'll link it in the description box.
Shameless plug from Julia. Thank you for that, Julia.
You're welcome.
All right, so let's buckle up and start with a very important development in the EU. So this is a positive one regarding the protection of whistleblowers, but I'm simply not going to preach the choir and state the obvious by saying, yeah, whistleblowers are awesome, we need them. Because that they're the drivers of positive change. And also, this is another reason. No. Because I know that, like, we know that most people that listen to us already know those things, right?
Yes. Everyone loves whistleblowers, especially Edward Snowden.
Okay. Okay, so let's just cut to the chase. But I also want to mention one thing very briefly before we get into the technical part of the story, like the EU affairs part of the story, which is why I find, or why this issue is important to green politics. Because whatever we talk about on the podcast, we're trying to see the correlation of that topic with political ecology, right? And when it comes to this particular topic, I just think that you cannot achieve any type of justice in a society if you don't have transparency or accountability, and which is, I think, why these two things constitute two of the core values of the philosophy behind political ecology.
Sure.
So you can't have social justice or environmental justice because we can't just possibly trust the people that hold incredibly powerful positions when it comes to uncovering corruption, because they benefit from it. It's just common sense. So we need those truth tellers, and the only way they can talk about these things is if they're protected, because most of the time they have so much to lose. So I think this is why this issue matters to the Greens. But this is also why it was shocking to me when I found out that only 10 EU countries have a comprehensive law protecting whistleblowers.
Wow.
Yeah. So that means it's currently, like, this whole thing is currently covered in a very fragmented manner, right? But there's more. The legislation currently in place is also a very sectoral one, meaning they're protected only in the areas of, for example, financial services. So this is why the Greens EFA group have been pushing for an EU-wide directive on whistleblower protection. A little bit of the timeline and a little bit of background on this. The group in question has presented the Commission with a model directive back in May 2016.
Okay.
And then the Commission presented a draft legal proposal earlier in 2018. Okay? You're following me?
Just about.
I can tell. Then the European Parliament made several essentially improvements to the draft in order to advance the protection of whistleblowers. But the overall aim is to agree on a final directive across the entire EU before the European elections of May 2019. Okay? So if we get this directive, it's going to be the first of its kind, and it'll oblige all 28 EU governments to introduce minimum standards of protection for whistleblowers, truth tellers.
Wow.
So let's go a bit further on the timeline. Last week, on the 25th of January, the Council agreed its negotiating position on the directive. So that means that this week, the trialogue negotiations will start, and we could be on the verge of enacting new legislation for all the EU member states. So that means there is a chance that this directive could be adopted before the EU elections, which is really important.
But I can't believe there wasn't already a directive on this.
Exactly. But that is because when it comes to political will, even in this process, right, which started in May 2016, EU governments were not as ambitious as either the European Parliament or the Commission in their positioning on this directive when they negotiated it in the Council. Mm. So this resulted in having different positions when it comes to certain important articles in the directive. So there are minor differences between what the Parliament had proposed to the Commission and the Commission's draft, and then what the Council had agreed on. And when I say minor, it's in the wording, but even though on paper these differences may seem very small, in practice, they will be interpreted in a way that may restrict the protection provided to whistleblowers, which I think is the Parliament's main concern too.
What kind of differences?
Okay, so I'll give you one example without making it sound too technical, complicated, or boring.
Mm, good luck.
I know. Everybody already unsubscribed.
I mean, you mentioned trialogue, and I think everyone just...
I know. That's when I lost everyone.
Yeah.
I know.
Lost me as well.
Okay, so for example, when it comes to whistleblowers reporting to regulators, not to the public, but just turning to the regulators, the Commission has proposed a three-tiered system, which basically means whistleblowers are obliged to report internally. Otherwise, they will not be protected. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They need to exhaust the internal procedures first. And then the Parliament said, no, we should allow whistleblowers to choose whether they report internally or externally to regulators, mm-hmm. to authorities.
Nice.
Okay? But what ended up happening is the Council went with the European Commission's three-tiered system,
mm-hmm.
and even made two changes to that proposal, making it stricter. Yeah. So that is the kind of difference I'm talking about. It's very technical. It's in the wording, but the implications of it in practice could make a huge difference when it comes to how much protection we could provide to whistleblowers.
Sure.
So this is where we're at right now. And when it comes to what people can do, so the group is launching a new campaign on whistleblower protection to create some global pressure, because we're going to have the trialogue negotiations this week. On social media, it's going to be called #truthneedsfriends.
Ooh, nice.
I know, right? It's quite catchy too. It's going to be launched on the 6th of February, Wednesday, at 10 CET. And they're calling on people to share the video they prepared for this campaign. The video was produced in 10 languages. So what you can do is you can share the video on Twitter, tag your Ministry of Justice and Permanent Representation Office in Brussels. That's how you can join this campaign.
Okay.
You should do that too, Julia.
Cool.
You have like a lot of followers.
Maybe.
You should totally do that. Don't rub it in. Don't
I
rub
will
it in,
do that. Yeah. I was looking for something to add about whistleblowers that wasn't just me fangirling over Edward Snowden or Chelsea Manning. I came across this amazing whistleblower that illustrates a lot of the points you're making, Sedan. She's across the pond in the US, but her name is Marsha Coleman Adebayo. And she was tasked in the 1990s to work for the US government and to support the new South African government after apartheid to transition to democracy.
Oh, so no pressure.
Yeah.
Easy thing to do.
Yeah. And to support the government on issues like public health, environmental safety. And so when she was in South Africa, she started getting reports about the really dangerous conditions that South African miners were under, especially miners who were mining this mineral called vanadium, which is crucial in the production of steel and helps make it resistant to both hot and cold. It's used in everything that we use everywhere, from forks to phones to cars. So this is a quote from her book about what people were telling her. They came to me complaining of green tongues. They told me about bleeding from every orifice. There were reports of many dead and more dying. And so she realized that miners were subjected to the most horrific poisonings and deaths because of the conditions that they were mining under. And these were American companies that were mining this.
Shocker.
Yeah. And so she kind of tried to raise awareness about this in her department and get this to change. And people kept saying, yeah, yeah, okay, we'll deal with it. And for years, she just waited and nothing happened. And every time she pushed, nothing would happen, but somehow things would start getting more hostile at work. She started getting impossible tasks and was subjected to more like racism and sexism that she also got from the start as well, needs to be added. At one point, things got so bad that she was getting death threats, rape threats, threats to her children for trying to expose what was happening, because she was exposing this huge scandal that people were trying to ignore, and also because she was pointing out the racism and sexism at the heart of the Environmental Protection Agency in the US.
Which makes people uncomfortable.
It makes them really uncomfortable. And her actions led to the introduction of really kind of historic protection laws for whistleblowers in the US that mean that you can't retaliate against your employee if they break silence about something that's happening. You can't discriminate against them. You have protections if you're a whistleblower. Because she said that in the federal government, if you were a manager, you were rewarded for silencing people who would tell the truth about uncomfortable things.
Exactly, because you're maintaining the status quo, and that's what matters.
Exactly. The act that was introduced after she took the government to court in 2002 is called the No Fear Act. And it does things like making companies tell employees about their rights every year and giving them protection and training about what to do if they come across something that isn't right. Yeah, these are things that we take for granted, but we forget that there's people that had to go through horrific experiences in order for this to be law.
Exactly. Because we look at it from such an external perspective that sometimes we just see these directives and laws and everything that's on paper. But with whistleblowers, all of their stories are so personal. Yeah. Every step that they had to take, every single decision that they had to make was so personal. But we benefit from all of those steps and decisions that they've made, you know?
That's so true. Yeah, that's so true. And they make huge sacrifices. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, she was brilliant. She was rising up through the Environmental Protection Agency. But she basically sacrificed everything. And I love this quote that she said, which is, whistleblowers are the ambassadors of democracy inside federal agencies. And she's got a brilliant book. It's called No Fear. And it won a Pulitzer Prize, actually.
Oh, okay.
She's, her case is so interesting to me because it highlights so many different important issues, you know, like protecting whistleblowers, environmental racism, mining, sexism, racism, corporate greed.
Exactly. I was just going to say, when the whistleblower is a woman, that again makes it very different.
And a black woman.
Exactly. Of course. Yes. Yes. Again, women have it different, whatever they're doing.
Absolutely. There's a whole extra layer of hatred and of threats that she got because it was even more subversive of her.
Yeah, and that's why this is also why it was shocking to me that only 10 EU countries have an actual comprehensive law protecting whistleblowers. But I guess it's also, it makes it even more special that we can have potentially have a directive before the EU elections, which is really strategically very important to have it before the elections.
Why is that?
Well, because you don't know what kind of parliament you're going to end up with.
Right.
You don't know what kind of political arena you're going to have after the elections. Everything can change.
Yeah.
You can lose this wave. You can lose this political will, which is not even ideal anyway, but
yeah.
You can even lose this. But this is also why this social media campaign can be really important, because the more pressure we put on the EU, the Brussels bubble, and all the people that are going to take part in the trilogue negotiations, we're going to have more chance of getting this directive before the EU elections.
Yeah, do it, everyone.
Tweet it.
Tweet it.
Let's dive into the situation in Venezuela. To be honest, it's hard to keep up with all the news coming our way, and I'm a bit confused about the whole thing. So, Julia, enlighten me, please. No pressure.
It's one of these topics where the more you learn, the more you realize how much there was to learn, how much history, how much context. And also, it's very emotional. People's positions are very ideological. So maybe I thought I would just pick out three main facts about Venezuela that we don't talk about that often.
Are they like fun facts?
They're not that fun.
No.
But they are facts. So as you all know, this economic crisis and political crisis has been ongoing since Chavez died in 2013. And Maduro took over. Economically, it's been, you know, horrific. There was, in 2017, hyperinflation of 2,700%.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. There's a new word for what they call the Maduro diet, which is how much weight people have lost since he came into power.
No.
Yeah. So in this context of economic crisis, environmental crisis, which I'll talk about, but also a political crisis, Juan Guaido emerges as a changemaker, basically. And he kind of came out of nowhere. You know, he was virtually unknown 2 months ago, which is partly why people find the whole thing quite disturbing in a way, that he rose to fame so quickly.
And a bit dodgy. Like, where did you come from?
Yeah. He's in the National Assembly, right?
Mm.
And it's his party's turn to be the chair of the National Assembly. So he took office in early January. And he's the only one he was able to take office from his party, because all of the main figures who are more famous are either out of the country or they're in prison.
Oh.
He declares Maduro to not have political legitimacy because the presidential elections last year didn't involve the three main opposition party because they were banned by Maduro. So he takes this opportunity just 2 weeks after Maduro is inaugurated for his second six-year term to say, look, this is when we're saying enough is enough. Maduro is not legitimate. Let's rise up. So before talking about whether the reasons to consider Maduro's mandate to be illegitimate are valid, I thought maybe we could look into what we don't hear much of about in this issue, and that's the environmental crisis. The main thing when we talk about the ecological crisis is to talk about this recent project that Maduro announced in 2016, which is called the Orinoco Mining Belt. And this is a huge area that sprawls from east to west in a kind of crescent shape. It's three times the size of Belgium. It's 12% of the country. Like, this is huge. And it's an area with huge oil deposits and lots of mineral deposits as well. It's got a lot of protected areas, natural monuments, biosphere reserves, wildlife refuges. There's also rare species such as the giant otter and jaguars.
Fun fact.
Fun fact there.
There you go.
And this area also has the Caroni River, which is the largest reserve of freshwater in the whole of Venezuela. And it provides hydroelectricity to plants that generate 70% of the energy consumed in the country. So in this area, Maduro granted mining concessions to transnational companies from around the world. And he did this without consulting the indigenous communities that live there. And there's quite a few. This is a clear violation of the ILO Convention 169. You know, you have to get the free, prior and informed consent of indigenous peoples if you want to mine or exploit their land in any way.
Right. That's kind of what's been happening with Justin Trudeau and the pipeline projects and Canada.
Right.
The question was whether he consulted.
Whether he got their free, prior and informed consent.
Exactly.
It's a very useful tool in international law to make sure that governments don't just bulldoze ahead and destroy all this land that is owned by indigenous people. And this is also very useful for the environmental movement, because that's how we're protecting a lot of valuable forests and woods around the world, wetland, because they're indigenous territories and that protects them. You know, indigenous struggles are key to environmental protection. So Maduro gave mining concessions to mining companies. But now what's happened is these mining companies have actually been pushed out by informal mining activities, which is supported by the army of Venezuela. So it's created a really strange, violent situation in this area. There's armed gangs. They compete with the military for gold, diamond and coltan areas. Local inhabitants, a lot of whom are indigenous, are kind of dragged into these violent conflicts and pushed into low-paid work, which could be mining, cleaning, prostitution. Crime has risen.
Wow. All this fight around resources, natural resources.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I knew that the country had the world's largest oil reserves, but I didn't know that this was the level that they had all of these things as well. And I knew that there was some tension around the oil reserves, but I also didn't know the level of conflict that they had over these natural resources. This is like my confession time about all the things that I don't know.
Well, I didn't know them either, to be honest, because no one's talking about this, even though it's a huge environmental disaster. As well as that, you've got these two massive lakes in Venezuela, Lake Maracaibo and Lake Valencia, which, you know, are surrounded by industrial areas and oil deposits. And they've been polluted and degraded to a really high level, which also damages the health of the residents around it.
Of course, yeah.
Environmental damage and degradation really impacts on local people. You can't separate environmental rights violations from human rights violations, from health rights violations and all of that. This crisis,
it's a great example of what you just said.
Exactly. It's even been called ecocide by the Venezuelan Greens because of the scale of the destruction that's happening silently in this Orinoco mining belt. This doesn't justify intervention into another nation's land because so many countries are doing awful things to their environments.
Exactly.
So the crucial question in this debate is when international communities and countries support Juan Guaido and declare him president, what are they doing? And are they justified in undermining President Maduro? Because he has a mandate, right? Actually, that's quite contested. And it was very interesting learning more about this because I didn't realize the extent to which he has undermined democracy in Venezuela, as well as the usual ways that authoritarian leaders centralize power, such as crippling checks and balances, taking power away from other arms of the government, centralizing power over the media. Maduro and his front bench own directly or indirectly about 90% of the media in Venezuela, as well as all the usual tactics that we're seeing in so many illiberal states, taking political prisoners, quelling protests violently, using the army. But I think that the key fact in this debate is the fact that in the presidential elections last year, he banned the three main opposition parties from taking part. And he justified this by saying, well, they boycotted the elections last year, the elections for this new constituent assembly that he set up, but the other parties didn't agree with and said that he should have had a referendum in order to do and just saw it as a way to cement his power. So they boycotted that election, not knowing that he would then say, you can't then take part in the presidential elections the year after. This is huge to ban political parties from taking part in elections. This is anti-democratic.
Kind of like what was happening in Rwanda for years and years.
Right, exactly. And even though Venezuela is not a one-party state, the slow consolidation of your power and undermining of the opposition until you are a one-party state is exactly what we have in China.
Exactly. It is a step towards that.
It is. And it's very scary for a lot of people in Venezuela. So this is the question, really. What does the international community do now? It's something that has varied across the world. We know that Trump in Canada endorsed Juan Guaido, which is probably rash considering that he's not elected as president by the people.
But is this kind of like two other governments are kind of choosing a country's leader?
Yeah. And certainly, I don't think it's cynical to think that Trump doesn't actually care about Venezuelans or Venezuelan democracy, but he just wants to undermine a socialist leader.
Yeah, but what about the people? Shouldn't people just, for example, just vote? Mm. Maybe?
So they're not even saying, oh, we're going to help you call free and fair elections and have a political dialogue.
Exactly.
Which is, of course, why it's ringing alarm bells for many people who are just seeing the same that history has shown us that happens in Latin America, which is you get rid of leaders you don't like and you just replace them with puppets.
Yes, over and over again.
And of course, for this reason, I think the reaction's also been perhaps too rash in condemning actual legitimate opposition to Maduro in Venezuela.
Exactly. They sounded like too pro-Maduro.
Exactly. It was like the history and the context prevented a lot of people, and I include myself in that until I did more research about it, to be honest, from seeing actually the reality of the democratic deficit. And I guess this reflects how Greens have reacted as well, because US Greens, who are obviously in a context where they're battling Trump and his black and white view of the world, they're extremely pro-Maduro. They just see this as neo-imperialism. And they're right in terms of that's what Trump's reaction is. But in terms of what's actually happening in Venezuela, they kind of ignore the real concerns that the opposition has mm-hmm. about Maduro.
Yeah, I just saw Jill Stein's tweet, the U.S. Green Party ex-presidential candidate. She condemned Washington's policy in Venezuela. And she said that the U.S. policy in Latin American countries is not about democracy at all. And she also said, quote, U.S. has backed right-wing coups up and down in Latin America for over 100 years. Mm. Not one was about democracy. All have been to enrich the global elite. But we're supposed to believe this time in Venezuela, which has the largest oil reserves, is different. End of quote. I mean, I kind of understand that because she's also trying to show everyone a little bit of background.
Mm.
Because you also need to understand that the U.S. also don't see it that way. They don't know that U.S. has been interfering with the domestic affairs of Latin American countries. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even sure if the members of the U.S. Congress would see it that way. And I'm not even sure if they have much of an idea about what's going on. I actually have a clip of what I'm referring to. Journalist Max Blumenthal asked the members of the U.S. Congress about Venezuela and the situation there. And this is what they said.
Do you think the U.S. is meddling in Venezuela?
I don't think so. I mean, we're the superpower in the world.
Maduro's troops or goons went into the ghetto and decided they were going to take over.
Isn't he the president of the country?
I mean,
his security forces.
Well, so perhaps.
Do you think the U.S. is meddling in Venezuela?
Are they meddling? Yeah, both sides are meddling.
But it's good meddling is what you're saying.
I don't know if it's good meddling or not.
I mean, any comment on the situation in Venezuela?
Oh, goodness gracious. As far as Venezuela is concerned, I think they did have a coup down there.
Yeah.
So, but what I'd like to see, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I got to go.
It is a coup.
It, to me, when you have something like that happen, I think we got to do something about it, but I'm so sorry. I got to go.
Okay, thanks.
Would I classify it as a coup happening? No, I wouldn't classify it as a coup.
How would you classify it?
I'll tell you what. I'd rather be interviewed from a position of fact rather than innuendo or opinion, especially since I just missed the briefing, which was just a couple hours ago.
Do you think the U.S. is meddling in Venezuela's political system?
I think we're just supporting the people and supporting what they are deciding needs to happen. And so I think that's good for us, since we are the bastion of freedom, to speak up and support other people around the world who are crying for freedom as well.
Quite incredible. Even though I completely agree with what you're saying, I think the problem is that Trump's extreme position on what they're reacting against, which is this history of real imperialism and self-interested interference in Latin America, means that they're pushed to the other extreme, where they're ignoring democratic concerns, where they're ignoring the plight of Venezuelans.
No, for sure.
Instead of bonding by also going to the other extreme, because you feel you need to in order to counter what you're hearing,
mm-hmm.
what would be great is if they were creating a new space where there was nuance, and when they were saying, okay, let's talk about this, this isn't black and white. I feel like that's what the European Greens have been doing.
Yeah, the Greens in the parliament, especially the British MEP Molly Scott-Cato, spoke about this in the European Parliament.
Like our colleagues from other groups, we utterly deplore the actions of the Maduro government. Economic mismanagement, the violation of human rights, and undermining the rule of law has pushed Venezuela to the brink and led to the exodus of 3 million citizens. However, in responding, we must not abandon key principles of international relations. The right of countries to self-determination and the right of people to choose their own leaders through a fully democratic process. Latin America has a long and tragic history of intervention by foreign players, motivated by self-interest and greed for its resources. Such interests must not be allowed to undermine the integrity of Venezuela or put the security of its citizens at even greater risk.
So it seems the Greens and to some extent the EU have carved a position outside this pro or anti-Maduro binary, calling for the self-determination of the Venezuelan people and for political dialogue and free and fair elections. And for me, I think it's clear that this is Green's position, because we're not wedded to this history of socialism, of attachment to, even though many Greens are individually, of course, you know, attached to socialism as an ideology and the manifestations of it around the world, I think we're more able to take a step back. And also we have these values within political ecology, which are very strong, which is pacifism.
Mm-hmm.
And non-intervention, and also anti-imperialism. And so for me, the way the Greens have reacted, apart from the US, which I think is a different context and also a different kind of party, which is less established than other Greek parties.
Exactly.
For me, that their response is really grounded in a respect of human rights and an understanding of democracy and a decentralization of power that goes beyond, oh, yeah, you just vote every 5 years and, oh, you got to vote, therefore it's democracy. For me, this whole situation kind of highlights an interesting question about where political ecology sits within the political spectrum. And I would argue that it kind of sits outside the traditional political spectrum, because in a way, it's a completely different paradigm. The only ideology that isn't rooted in economic growth, for one thing. This highlights for me how you can be a socialist, but unless you're a democratic socialist, you may find that democracy is not that important for you and that you'll be happy to undermine it in order to continue your socialist aims.
So the means are not that important as long as you achieve that aim.
Exactly. You can also be a socialist government or even a democratic socialist government. But if you neglect the environment, you will also necessarily end up repressing the people that you claim to be working for, because environmental degradation and pollution will harm their health, will harm their mental well-being, will deny their right to decide what happens to their land, and will lead you to having to repress activists.
You'll end up with human rights violations anyway.
And these activists are often exactly the people that you claim to want to help, because they're indigenous people, they're peasants, they're rural communities who are defending their lands. So for me, this exemplifies why political ecology is so much more than just socialism with added environmentalism in there. Like, it's a whole different way of seeing the world.
You can follow us on Twitter at Big Green Pop Pod. And if you haven't already, subscribe to the show so you can hear it every 2 weeks. You can find us on any podcast platform. Thanks so much, and see you in 2 weeks.